Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
We're going to do something different this week on the podcast by turning the microphone around and doing exactly what the title of this show suggests, by going inside the hive. I'm going to sit down with the editor of Vanity Fair's The Hive, John Kelly, and no, not the John Kelly who is the chief of staff of the White House right now. This is a different John Kelly, and we're going to discuss what's really going on in Silicon Valley. We're going to talk about Travis Kalanick and how his impatience built Uber into a $70 billion company, but at what cost? We'll talk about what Mark Zuckerberg is really doing on his road trip that looks awfully like a presidential bid. And if Twitter is going to survive the Donald Trump apocalypse. And if it does, what exactly is Jack Dorsey's plan to save the company? Or is it just doomed? I'll answer all those questions and more, but first I want to pass the microphone over to my editor, John Kelly.
Nick, thanks for having me. It is an honor and a privilege to be on Inside the Hive.
Thanks for coming on the show.
I wanted to talk to you first about Uber. One of the things that you've done as much as anybody I know is write about how the origin of these Silicon Valley companies end up affecting them when they're kind of more mature. Can you tell me a little bit about how Uber was founded and why it's not so surprising that it has this bombastic, controversial leader who even in exile seems to be trying to reclaim the throne of his company?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to kind of to set this up is really to think about the one, the only Mr. Black Turtleneck, Steve Jobs. The founding of Uber and the founding of Twitter and the founding of Facebook and all those companies actually goes back to the founding of Apple. And Jobs had this kind of management style that was, to be quite frank, being a jerk. He believed that he was here to push people to their limits. I'm just going to do a little parenthetical here and tell you a little story that I heard that I never forgotten about Jobs. When he was doing when he was building the iPod, they were incredibly secretive and they were building these prototypes and that were cost millions and millions of dollars. Like a single iPod cost millions of dollars. And there's one day that his engineering team came into his office or into an office or something at Apple, and they brought in this latest iPod, and it looked kind of like an iPod, but twice as thick. And they said, "This is the thinnest we can get this thing." And Jobs stood there and looked at it, asked a bunch of questions. And then he walked over to the fish tank and he dropped this like $3 million prototype into the fish tank. And everyone's face was like, "Oh my God, what did he just do?" And he said, "Look, there's bubbles coming out of it. There's still room to make it smaller." And so that was the jerk mentality that ended up pushing people to make it smaller. And I think he ended up building the most successful technology company on the planet, and it kind of justified his jerkiness. And I think that when you look at people like Travis Kalanick, they believed that, in order for me to be successful, I have to be an asshole. And the company was built that way from the moment it started. We are the little guy. We're going after the taxi industry, which is the big guy, and we're going to do everything we can to win. And if we have to cut people off at their feet or subvert regulation or have a hyper-aggressive culture of engineers that is grossly sexist or completely anti-regulation and government in any form whatsoever, then that's what we're going to do. And the end result is that you have a $68 billion company, but you also have a CEO who has built one of the most toxic cultures I think I've seen in a long, long time.
What's fascinating about Uber, which is obviously, we're talking about it because Kalanick is in exile for overseeing an operation that had a programmer culture. That's the phrase you hear used frequently. But what that means, I think, is that there was rampant sexual harassment in the workplace that we now know about. We've seen video of Kalanick berating drivers. It seemed like a generally unhappy place. If it were a public company, it's likely that he would have been pushed out a long time ago. But that's fascinating about Uber is it got to where it is because it was fundamentally like an illegal enterprise from the get-go, right? It was breaking into markets where it was doing things that were against existing regulations. I mean, Uber's sort of mantra in the early days was they literally were going to change laws in order to be able to operate. Is it any surprise that it turned out this way?
No, I think that what happened is, I think to a certain degree these companies are right. You know, I think that the regulation that existed with the taxi industry had led to an industry where getting a cab was like torture in Game of Thrones. It was brutal. You know, the car stunk. The driver was pissed off at you, even though you were paying for this ride. You couldn't get a ride. You know, in places like New York City, the people who owned the taxis were paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for medallion fees to be able to have a taxi. You know, there were people that were skimming up at the top and the side and the bottom, and it was just a screwed up industry. And the initial idea was brilliant. It was like, oh, let's try to break this and make it better. And I think that most things that come out of Silicon Valley, the initial concept is pretty good. It is this idea of this is broken, let me fix it. And the problem, I think, is they take it to these extremes. You know, with Uber, that always being the little guy, always fighting, always on mentality, led them to do things that were just diabolical. I mean, and you know, and there was that thing that Mike Isaac from the New York Times wrote about called Grayball, where they had an app that they gave to people who were regulators in Portland when they would show them a different version of Uber, so that they couldn't get caught doing illegal things. There was instances in San Francisco with the DMV where the DMV said, we're not going to let you take your driverless cars and put them on the streets because we don't know if they're safe. And Uber just did it anyway. And you saw these things happen time and time again. And then also, I think the biggest one was the lack of, because they wanted to grow so quickly and get around these regulations by the government, there was the lack of oversight, checking on drivers and making sure they didn't have records for felonies and so on, and a lot of them did. And you saw, you know, some pretty bad things happen as a result of that. And I think for Travis, the idea was, you know, I'm going to do whatever I have to win. And if there are some dead bodies along the way, then so be it. And I think that everyone kind of played along with that, the investors, the employees, everyone, because the company was growing so quickly and the valuation was just so massive, until the point that it all kind of came crashing down. And the only reason that he got fired, in my opinion, was because it was a potential that the valuation of the company was gonna be lowered. It had nothing to do with the ethics and morals.
Do you remember when you first started hearing about Kalanick in the Valley? Do you remember when you first started to hear venture capitalists talking about wanting to get into the company? Because to my mind, one of the things that made Uber such an appealing bet was Travis's personality, right? He was somebody who was just an absolute killer, and VCs will always say that they're investing in the person as much as they're investing in the enterprise.
Yeah, I do remember because I had just moved to Silicon Valley when Uber had just started, and I remember it because I didn't have a car at first when I first got there, and a friend of mine who's kind of like tapped into everything that's going on in tech. I remember I called a taxi one day or something, and he was like, why don't you just get an Uber? And I was like, what the hell is an Uber? And he's like, it's this new company that Garrett Camp, who had started StumbleUpon, had started. And Garrett was the main funding source behind Uber. And so I remember ordering it, and it was really cool and neat. It was expensive because it was black cars back then, so you were paying kind of a premium for a ride. And the original goal was black cars. And back then, Travis was involved, but a guy named Ryan Graves was actually running the company. And what happened was it quickly became apparent that this thing was something that was actually going to be big because, you know, while I was just a New York Times journalist not making that much money, there were a lot of people in Silicon Valley that were, and they started immediately stopping to use their car and starting to use Uber black cars, and so they realized there was a market there. And Ryan, who's a very sweet guy, was not an aggressive human being, and was essentially said, they said, okay, you're not going to run the company, Travis is. And I remember meeting him for the first time, and I had a conversation with someone, and I was like, he seems really aggressive, not realizing just how aggressive he was. And the person said to me, well, he had this company in the past and he kind of got screwed over, and he has something to prove to everyone that he can make this thing successful. And I think that once it started to take off, he was not going to take his foot off the gas pedal. He was just going to go as fast as he could.
You're right. Uber started as a black car company. I think that's probably what inspired the name, right? That it was this exclusive sort of big business meeting and nightclub and from the airport sort of transportation thing. But part of what excites investors now is it's a logistics network, and maybe it'll work in a driverless universe. But certainly when you see things like Uber Eats or Uber Ice Cream, which is now having a promotion that I just walked past, taking over a big part of Union Square, Uber could be all kinds of things. It could be a competitor to FedEx or Amazon in some way. Was that clear, at least to you or to Kalanick or to VCs in the early days, that this could mushroom well beyond just being a taxi service?
Oh, I don't think so. I never imagined it would. You know, I remember the shock and awe when they started letting normal people without black cars come on the service. And I remember taking a black car to the airport in San Francisco, and the guy spent the entire drive complaining about how the service was going to crumble because the whole reason people used Uber was just because they wanted the luxury experience, and now you're just going to be getting in some random guy's car. Clearly, Travis and Garrett and company had a vision for what was going to happen. I don't know if in the beginning they, and in fact I do know that factually they did not envision in the beginning that it was going to be a logistics service. In the beginning it was like, I can't get a taxi, this is a bullshit experience, let me fix it. But I think that very quickly they realized that. And that was when I think that investors really started to get excited. Because it's one thing to take on the taxi industry and try to disrupt that. But the idea, and this is what Amazon is doing, but they're doing it a lot quieter than Uber did. You know, it's that last mile where how do you get something to someone in that last mile? And Uber Eats, of course, is that attempt. And Amazon's drone project is that attempt. And driverless cars, of course, will be that attempt. And I think that the concept that you could imagine anything being brought to you by an Uber was the thing that really started to push that valuation through the roof until it got to close to $70 billion.
One of the things that I think about frequently now that Uber is going through this leadership crisis, something you mentioned to me a while ago, maybe even a year ago, when you were working on your Theranos reporting for that great Elizabeth Holmes story, you said that there weren't a lot of murmurs in the wider world and the media about what was going on behind the scenes at Theranos, at least in early days, that there were some entrepreneurs and people around the Valley who were skeptical about the sort of science that the company was producing. There certainly were people in the academy saying the same. But you mentioned to me that a lot of entrepreneurs were giving Holmes the benefit of the doubt because they knew that in the life cycles of their own company, there was, for lack of a better term, sort of a fake it till you make it culture, that you have to do a lot of things to – starting a company is hard. You have to do a lot of things to get it off the ground. Was there some sort of latitude with Uber in early days? Because we've been hearing stories for a long time about a culture problem there. These latest emails that Kara Swisher at Recode reported about Travis Kalanick saying these disgusting things before going down to Miami on a company trip out, he wasn't going to sleep with anyone – That all sounds revolting, but it's not entirely at odds with what we were kind of hearing about what was going on there, right?
Well, yes, but the thing is, I think we all knew about it, but people still used Uber. There was the first inkling of when there started to be some backlash. Was when people kind of started to get fed up several months back. With Uber, when I believe it was during some sort of crisis or event where Uber was surge charging people To get out of a certain area. I forget the specifics of it, but people started to say, you know, they started to be the hashtag delete Uber. And that was when, that was the first time I remember Uber responding to a crisis, but there was something that happened with that, but there was also Travis joining, the Trump, tech board. And which of course pushed him to get off that board. And I remember, you know, I remember writing a piece when I was at the New York Times about Uber surge pricing and how I thought it was pretty ridiculous and despicable, because you had people that were, you know, using an Uber to get to work, and then they would try to get home from work, and their Uber would cost seven times what it was because, you know, because of surge pricing. And Travis was, you know, he was pissed at me after I wrote that piece. He sent me like a nasty note. He said, "I thought you were a friend of Uber, blah, 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 blah." But they never changed. You know, they had so much negative press, and they never changed that surge pricing rule. And this, what happened a few months back when he, when the first delete Uber hashtag started to erupt through San Francisco and Los Angeles and places like that, was the first time they ever actually responded to anything negatively. And I think it was because they saw that people were actually not using the service. And I think that that was the beginning of the end for them, you know, and it just opened the floodgates for people to come after them for everything and anything. And eventually, the thing that I find so amazing is, like with all whistleblower stories where you have the big bad CEOs and the big bad companies doing the big bad things, it just takes one person who's brave enough to say something aloud. And it was a woman engineer who had thought the culture was toxic, wrote a blog post about it, and that was it. That was the beginning of the end for Travis Kalanick.
Yeah, there's sort of no question that Susan Fowler was the heroine of Silicon Valley over the last 12 months. But one of the things that's so fascinating to me about how this has all played out has to do with, I guess, the way that innovation is funded in Silicon Valley. That it comes from these venture capitalists who have money from their limited partnerships, which usually get money from mutual funds, retirees, pensioners, whatever. And those guys are looking for the one big payday. And so while someone who had exhibited Kalanick's behavior might have been pushed out or exiled at the slightest indication that there was, you know, trouble behind the scenes, that it might affect the stock price, the people who were behind Uber, who were invested fiscally in Uber, they're incentivized to want a huge payday, right? So if people are using the product, they're incentivized to say, well, you know, let's get beyond the personality politics here. Do you think that this is sort of a, you know, case study in the problem with the private capital markets as they exist now?
Well, I mean, the thing, if you ask me for a list of things that piss me off about Silicon Valley, top of the list is the VCs that go around pretending that they're there to make the world a better place, when they're just there to make as much money as they humanly can. And that's a perfect example of that. You know, they invest in anything that they can. You know, these VCs, for the most part, they're not these geniuses that can see the future. They go into a casino called Silicon Valley, and they put a few chips down on everything they see on the table, and eventually one of those things is going to have a 1,000 or 2,000x return, and that's where they make their money. You know,
The Facebooks or the Google, they're looking to hit on one huge, huge, huge thing.
You hit one Facebook, and your return on investment can be, you know, for a few million bucks can be $1 billion, and it pays for your entire fund for, and all the screw-ups. You know, 95% of investments by venture capitalists are complete failures, and they're a couple million dollars a piece, so it doesn't make a difference to them, because they're going to make it up on the back end with a Facebook or an Uber or something like that. And this was actually one of the big undoings for Travis. Travis didn't want to go public with Uber. Someone close to him told me that he had a conversation with Mike Bloomberg once, And he asked Bloomberg for advice, and Bloomberg said, you know, wait as long as you can to go public, because once you go public, you're beholden to the shareholders and the markets and this, that, and the other. And the longer you can
and
stave
Bloomberg
it off.
Company, of course, is still private, by the way, right?
Yes, exactly.
The big take home there is that
exactly.
Bloomberg LP is still a private partnership. But so Travis took that to heart?
Well, Travis took that to heart, and he said, you know, he told the board he didn't want to take the company public yet. So you've got this board of people who are in one of these companies with, you know, with could be, you know, I remember when I first heard about Uber, it was valued at like $5 million. It was, you know, funded by Garrett Camp, hadn't had any public funding yet. If you had have put $25,000 into Uber back then, it would be worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars today, just 25 grand. There's nothing that you could put money into where you could reap that kind of return. And so the investors that put in tens of millions of dollars are set to make billions and billions of dollars in profits, but they can't pull that money out until the pump company goes public. And so you have, you know, Benchmark Capital and other outlets that were really pushing for the company to go public on the board. And Travis, who stuck his heels in and decided not to, and when there was the opportunity to finally push him out, that was the thing that was at the top of the pile that kind of pushed everything else forward.
So I guess it's not surprising that one of the things we're hearing now is that the board is looking for a CEO who can take Uber public, so that they can cash out.
Completely, yeah. They you know. There's, as I've reported and Kara Swisher's reported and others have reported, you know, the board is kind of in total chaos and disarray right now, because some people on the board, namely Arianna Huffington, want to bring Travis back. Other people on the board, you know, want their money back. And so there's this third party, which is SoftBank, which is like, I will buy your shares of Uber, and you can cash out a little bit. And then if that happens, then Travis could use SoftBank's vote to bring himself back to the company, which he wants to do, and so on and so forth. But then there's a large group of people on the board who want to bring in a seasoned CEO, essentially like a Dick Costolo at Twitter, who can straighten the ship, take it public, and, you know, and a year later they can be out of the company. And I think that is essentially what will happen unless the SoftBank thing goes through. I think that they will get someone like that, not the greatest CEO in the world, not the worst, and that person will you know, see this thing through to the public markets. And then I think what will end up happening is Travis will try to make a return.
Taking Uber public is interesting in and of itself. I want to get back to Travis Kalanick in a second and his quest to return, because I think you're right. That seems to be where the narrative is headed. But very few Silicon Valley companies have gone public in the last couple of years, and the ones that have, such as Blue Apron, appear to already be in the coffin, basically. I mean, you know, that they're judged so differently by the public markets than they are privately, where investors are looking for an exit, hoping for an acquisition or something like that. Is Uber, which I think is still, you know, bleeding cash as it tries to grow and expand, and looking at headwinds such as the driverless car race, is it built to succeed in the public markets, or should they be listening to Mike Bloomberg and continue as a private limited partnership?
Oh, I think it's definitely built to succeed in the public markets, because it's only tapped into one or two of its potential businesses and revenue streams so far. You know, the company bought the driverless trucking company Otto a year earlier, and putting aside all the chaos there for a moment, and the, you know, the lawsuit from Google, the goal with that was, oh, well, here's our next market that we're going to go after, the trucking industry, and, you know, which forget about the 10.5 million jobs that will be lost as a result, but there's billions and billions of dollars to be made to get things across the country. You know, they imagined a world at Uber where you could Uber anything anywhere, and the logistics, you know, I give Uber credit for a lot because of what they did, but the thing I really give them credit for is that from what I've heard from employees there, is that they had built this system that is essentially almost like artificial intelligence, where they can predict essentially where people are going to want things at what time. You know, they can predict that on a Friday night at 10 o'clock on the corner of Fairfax and Hollywood, within a certain period of time, someone's going to call a car. And they can kind of make sure that their cars are in the area based on where people are picked up and dropped off and things like that, based on that. So the goal, just like it was, you know, with pizza, it was like, we'll get you a pizza in 30 minutes, back in the 80s and 90s. The goal with Uber was you shouldn't have to wait more than 5 minutes for a car. And so that if you take those logistics and then you then start to apply them to things that people need and want, like their coffee in the morning or a pizza at night or whatever it is, Uber was perfectly set up to destroy anyone that got in its way in that quest, except one company, which was Amazon. And I think that that is, you know, if we kind of fast forward, if the company does go public and whether Travis comes back or not, I do think that the next iteration of Uber would be an Uber versus Amazon fight, because they're trying to do the exact same thing.
It's a sort of chilling future to envision, because it does seem as we march forward in time, there's this race towards like gigantism, where there are only a few companies left in the world, that everything else is just going to kind of be sucked up into them. But before we get to that future yet, I just want to ask about the autonomous, the self-driving solution, the next market for Uber, because it does seem like it depends on the resolution of this very significant legal skirmish that they're in with Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, which is also a parent company to a company called Waymo, which Alphabet is saying is where the self-driving technology for auto, which Uber has acquired, was really created. If Uber loses on this front, is it a sign that they're not going to make it to the next step, which is a sort of self-driving future where they can take advantage of this large logistics web that they've created and all this predictive analytics that they've been able to garner, and that they won't actually be able to take it to market?
No, I think well, just to set this up, I mean, I think, you know, when you look at this lawsuit, it shows you how important the future of driverless cars is to these companies. Google's venture arm, Google Ventures, put in $350 million into Uber as an investor, which is probably worth several billion dollars today. And yet Google is willing to throw
that's a
that
Nick built in advance check, right? From
is
that one
pretty
of your
much
advance checks from American Kingpin?
I'm literally sitting here in my Olympic sized swimming pool doing this podcast right now. So playing with my drones. So for them, that's a lot of money, you know. But for Google, for Alphabet, it's like, well, we're willing to throw that away to ensure that that Uber doesn't come after the thing that we've been working on for 10 years, which is driverless cars. And so it sets up just how important this is to these companies. The thing is, I do think that there is an out for Uber in this thing. Maybe they settle, maybe they're forced to pay, you know, Alphabet $1 billion. Maybe the case gets thrown out. Who knows? Maybe. But let's just say that they lost. I think that they would be able to go along and buy another company and use that technology. I think it would put them in a really, really bad place for the future, because they'd have to play catch up with all the technology they've used. But I do think that – I don't think it means the end of Uber. But it was – you know, it's a perfect example. I think that this is a really interesting point about how quickly they were – you know, Travis was driving this company. He didn't do the due diligence that he should have done when he purchased this company to see if there were these problems with Otto and the CEO and so on. And he was in such a rush to get it that he got something, you know, that ended up coming to bite him in the ass. And Mark Zuckerberg did the exact same thing with Oculus when he purchased Oculus VR. And it turned out there was some patent issues there too. And it was partially because he wanted to get it before anyone else did.
That's true. He could be forgiven for not knowing that Palmer Luckey was a nascent Donald Trump supporter. That would all play out later. But let's talk more about this kind of march to gigantism, because one point that you've made to me a lot is that we're nearing an eventuality where all these companies, which all seem to be in complementary businesses now, Uber does transportation. Netflix is an entertainment company. Google is search and moonshots, and Apple is, you know, phones and stuff that you need. But there's a future maybe not that long in the offing where they're all kind of competing with each other in what they do on a core level. Do you want to sort of paint this potentially dystopian future?
Completely. I believe that in the future, I don't know how far off this future is, but that there'll be little companies and there'll be medium companies, but there will predominantly be four major companies that are worth $1 trillion a piece or more: Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon. And you know, even just today, those four companies are worth $2.5 trillion. And what's so fascinating is if you kind of back up and look at it, you know, Google started out doing search. Today, they have driverless cars and venture arms and all these things that, you know, the biggest phone business on the planet, where, you know, by the time this podcast is done, 1.5 million new Android devices will have been activated. You know, they do all these things. Apple started out making computers. Its main business now is smartphones. It's also working on a driverless car system. It's also starting to do original content. Amazon has a whole segment of its company that does original content just so it can get people to sign up for Amazon Prime so that they'll buy more toothpaste from Amazon. You know, if you don't think that Amazon is going to put out a driverless car in the next X period of time, you have no concept of what that company is thinking about. Like, they, for them, getting things to your house, including yourself, is their business, and they're doing everything. And what's so interesting is a company like Amazon or Uber or whatever it is can buy one company and eviscerate a market. And we saw this happen when Amazon announced that it was buying Whole Foods. And the stock of every other supermarket dropped by a quarter of its market cap on the same day, and that's because people are terrified. Because once Amazon can get its food to you, Whole Foods to you, why would you go anywhere else? And once they can reduce the price, because that's what they do so well, why would you go anywhere else? And what happens when Amazon releases its flying drones and its driverless car fleet that then starts to compete with Uber and Google and so on and so forth?
Right. So in this future, Uber could be a company that drives your morning coffee to your home and has its mobile fitness center where you run on the treadmill watching entertainment that is Uber produced or owned or something like that?
Oh, it's way more than it drives its coffee to your home. In the future, let's just say that you decide that Uber is your company that you use to get to work every day. So let's just look at driverless cars for 1 minute. So in the future of driverless cars, are right today, if I go and I get in my car and I drive away from my house and go get a coffee, whatever, there's five seats and there's a steering wheel and gas pedals and so on. If I'm not driving, I don't need the five seats. I don't need the steering wheel. And, you know, the car can be rearranged. So if the future of driverless cars is what we think it is, which is that most people, except the 1%, the 99% of us will not have a car. We will call one. You can imagine that I say, "Oh, I'm going to a meeting. I'm going to call a car that has a treadmill so I can work out on the way to the meeting." Or I want to watch a TV show, so I'm going to call a car that has a big flat screen TV. Or I want to have a meeting and record this podcast with John on my way to lunch, so we'll get a meeting car. The whole concept of what a car is will change. But once you start to look at the algorithms and the predictions that people will make, you can imagine that that Uber says, "Oh, I know Nick likes to watch CNN in the morning." I don't actually like to watch CNN, but let's pretend I do for this hypothetical. He likes to watch CNN in the morning, and he likes coffee from Blue Bottle. And so this Uber shows up based on my having access to my calendar, because it knows I have a meeting in Santa Monica, and it shows up predicting what the traffic will be to get there at the exact moment I need to get in the car with that hot coffee and tuned into CNN already. And that is that's the very easiest, simplest version of what this future might look like.
Right, and in that future, Uber, the company potentially doing all this, is competing head-to-head against a bunch of other businesses that are probably doing presumably similar sort of offering too.
Yeah,
right?
Amazon, going head-to-head. Amazon has these concepts where they're working on with grocery stores, and one of them is a prototype they have where you walk into a grocery store and there's no cashiers, and you just pick things up, and based on these cameras and sensors and things, and you walk out. That's your grocery shopping done, and it's charged to your account. Let's just say Amazon says, "Oh, we're going to buy a refrigerator company," and they give you the refrigerator for free because this is how Amazon does things, and it can monitor all the things in your fridge, and it knows your milk just went bad. It automatically sends you milk, and it just shows up at your door from a drone or whatever. Maybe you're emailing some friends about doing a dinner party on Friday night, and you ask, "Hey, who's vegetarian, who's not?" People respond, and Amazon you just forward it to Amazon or whatever, or they just read the email and they send you all the ingredients that they know that you need. They know you don't need rice vinegar for that sushi that you're making, so they don't send you that, but they send you everything else, and it shows up at your doorstep on Friday afternoon so you can cook it all, because they are competing with Blue Apron that does the same thing.
When you talk about this gigantic future of these huge mega companies, one thing that's interesting is a lot of people, I think, do agree with you that it's probably Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple are positioned to be head-to-head competing at that trillion-dollar level. If you look at those companies, those are all still generally founder-led companies, with the exception of Apple. Obviously, Steve Jobs is the founder, but Tim Cook was very much a disciple. Google, run by the founders after a period where Eric Schmidt was this sort of adult in charge, managing the company towards a massive scale. Facebook is obviously entirely follows the vision of its founder. I'll get back to Zuckerberg in a second. Amazon is Bezos. You could see venture capitalists in a room, right, saying that if Uber is going to compete with these guys at this level, if Uber, which is already worth like $68 billion in only 7 years, if it's going to be a trillion-dollar company, we need the founder to be running it. We need Kalanick's vision. And so what if he made some egregious mistakes presiding over the culture of the company or berating drivers? We can look past that, right? Is that the sort of like fundamental moral challenge that we're facing right now with Uber?
No, because I think that you give the investors the credit that they really care about building a company that lasts for 50 years. I don't think that's the case anymore. I remember my grandfather investing in some of these blue chips, and these were investments for when he was 30 years old to that he was going to cash out when he was 80. And there was this long haul vision of what a company would be. And I think today, especially with the investors in a company like Uber or any of these tech companies, they want in, they want out, and that's it. They, I don't think that anyone on that board wants to be there in 10 years and really gives a shit what Uber looks like in 10 years. I think that they see a company that they invested a certain amount of money in that's going to make them into multi-billionaires, and that's it.
You wrote a really good story recently about founders who'd been in Kalanick's shoes before, like Jobs and Dorsey, who had been pushed out, gone off into the wilderness. In both of their cases, they started new companies. But they also seemed to come back with a little bit of some sort of level of maturity that really stoked the interest of Wall Street. Kalanick's only been out of this company for like 6 weeks. Do you think he's going to be – and we're, 6 weeks and we're already hearing that he wants back in. You've reported that it's not a matter of if, but when. Do you think that he's going to go off and start his own version of Square so that he can prove to Wall Street that he's matured and he can take over Uber at the next step? And at the same time, do you think that this whole act, this whole kind of Hamlet maneuver that he's going through, is that going to screw over the company as it tries to find a CEO who can take it public?
I don't think that he is going to go off, start a refrigerator company or whatever it is, or Square or a Pixar or whatever. and try to come back in a couple of years. I think that Travis, and look, every tech reporter who spends a lot of time in Silicon Valley meets all the people they end up covering. And I can't think of a successful CEO who I haven't interacted with on a personal basis at one point or another. And they all have their faults and they all have their qualities. And I cannot think of a single person who I have met in over a decade covering this industry who is more aggressive than Travis Kalanick. He is, somebody once said he's like, it's like a gorilla that like got out of the zoo and he's just beating his chest in front of you. And he is an incredibly aggressive, impatient human being. And that has worked to his strength. As a result of that, Uber is worth $70 billion and it is as big as it is. But in this instance, I think it's his biggest weakness because you can't just come back in like a bulldozer and try to take over a company just because you want to be the guy who takes over it. You have to be strategic. And, you know, Jack Dorsey figured this out very quickly. He realized that when he was kicked out of Twitter in 2008, I believe it was, he had to kind of, he had to get his stuff together. He was considered an incredibly bad CEO. There were all these stories out there about how he would, you know, leave work early to go to hot yoga class, and he was more focused on his sewing classes where he was learning how to make A-line skirts than he was about fixing the server outages and a litany of other problems with the company and himself. And so rather than try to ram his way back into the company, he kind of went through a makeover. He helped start Square with an old high school friend of an old friend of his from back home in St. Louis. He got rid of the nose ring and the blue dreadlocks and all the other stuff that he had. He started to dress more like an adult. He started to wear suits. And he went on this kind of tour that kind of was a little bit messed up because he took a lot of credit for a lot of things he didn't do. But he went on this tour out in the public and spoke at conferences and at Stanford and was on the cover of magazines and things like that, talking about how he solely invented Twitter and solely invented Square and so on. And those things, of course, caught up to him later. But it worked. And what happened was he went back to Twitter and maneuvered the board in a way that I actually find quite astounding, especially given the way he was kicked out of the company. But he was incredibly smart and manipulative and strategic, and he ended up coming back to the company, not just a second time, but a third time. Steve Jobs did the same thing. He went off, he started Pixar. He did not try to get back into Apple. He was incredibly bitter about it, but he didn't try to get into Apple straight away. And eventually he saw an opening and very strategically pounced. Travis is like literally, you know, running around like a crazy person trying to figure out how to get back in. And I spoke to someone at the company who said, you know, he should come back one day. I truly believe he should come back, but not now. Like, let the company fix its problems, let the company go public, and then he can come back. And let him go and go through this phase of being changed. And right now, the only person who, you know, believes that he's already changed is Arianna Huffington, who's going around telling everyone that he's changed, darling. He's a changed man.
Steve Jobs obviously worked historically well at Apple the second time around. Jack Dorsey, it's probably too soon to tell, although it certainly has not provided the massive stock bump that, at the very least, investors were looking for. Twitter still seems to be struggling and it has not been able to increase its monthly active users, with the exception of our president, who's playing golf right now, threatening a nuclear winter. It's not as popular as it used to be. But let's play a little game here. Where do you think Uber is going to be in 5 years or in 10 years? Is Kalanick going to, presuming that he gets back in charge, is he going to be a Dorsey or a Jobs?
I think that my prediction is, I think that once you run a $70 billion company, And there's one exception here, and I'll get to that exception in a minute. Once you run a $70 billion company, I think it's very difficult for you to be comfortable in your own skin running a $100 million company. Somebody like Travis loves the power that he gets from that, and loves, you know, loves solving those big problems and taking on those big entrenched industries and the regulators and winning. And that's, you know, it's no different than a hedge fund guy on Wall Street. The exception is, and I've spoken to a few actual entrepreneurs about this who have run big companies and then gone on to run smaller companies. And they said that the thing that changed for them between those instances was that they had kids. And as someone, you have a son and I have two kids, as someone who has kids, it makes total sense to me that your goals in life change dramatically, and you appreciate the time that you have with your kids, and you realize that, you know, being a $70 billion company is not all that you're here to do. And I think that, you know, if Travis doesn't succeed in coming back right now, and rather than go and build a company, he goes and works on himself and maybe falls in love and has a family, I think he could come back, and or he could not. If he doesn't, if he continues down the path that he's on, which is to come back at all in all senses of the word, I do think that he'll come back eventually. But I don't think it'll work out for him the way he thinks. I could imagine him coming back and seeing this change company and trying to change the culture back to what it was, and failing and probably having to leave again.
Let's talk for a second about another entrepreneur, founder, Silicon Valley giant who is in the process of having his second kid and actually does seem like he's been slightly transformed by that process. You wrote this week about Mark Zuckerberg. You said you don't think that he's going to run for president in 2020, which is something, is a sort of, you know, meme in the world. A Zuckerberg-Trump 2020 race, it just boggles the mind so much. So I'm relieved to know that that seems less likely than it did maybe 2 months ago. But you have said that you think Zuckerberg is going to seek higher office in some way one day, and that he seems to be aware now of not just what Facebook can do in terms of connecting the world, but also is aware of the enormous importance that Facebook plays and needs to be safeguarded because of what it can unleash negatively into the world too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one of, you know, the problem with Mark Zuckerberg, and I know he's listening to this podcast. He's a huge fan. He's probably grilling some meat right now and playing with his dog as he listens to us talk about him. If he is listening, which I know he's not, he needs to fire his photographer. And just one of the biggest problems with his trope around the country has been that he has this these photographers with him and all these people around him like he's running for friggin' president. And he takes these stupid photos of that, you know, that Trump would have taken or Hillary would have taken with him with firefighters or helping clean up a mess with actually, Trump would never have done any of those things, but a traditional politician would have, you know, working with, you know, talking to people from the opioid epidemic and so on and so forth. And they make it look like his trip around the country is not a fact-finding mission or a way to meet people that use Facebook, but a political campaign. And I think that he would serve himself to fire not just his photographer, but probably a lot of the people on his comms team, and just go around the country with his security detail and take a few selfies, or not take any pictures. Putting that aside, you know, I spoke to a lot of people in the Valley about what was going on, why he was doing what he was doing, and the consensus that I heard was that, you know, he woke up on the morning of the election and after the election and was quite terrified as to who ended up in the White House, given that he has a daughter now and now another child on the way. And I think he at first did not believe that Facebook had played any role in the outcome of that election, which is astounding to me, because that was the first thing that I thought. But at the same time, over a period of a few weeks, as they started to kind of you know, do a little bit of navel gazing, they started to realize, oh, Facebook did play a massive, massive role in Trump getting into the White House. Probably not as big of a role as Twitter did, but a massive role nonetheless. And so he went on this fact-finding mission to travel around the country and so on. And we can chalk it up to just being that. The thing that points to the fact that I do believe, and the other people I've spoken to do believe, that he does want to do something in public office one day, is an amendment they made to the S-1 where they said that Zuck could remain CEO for a two-year period and also serve in public office in the government. The belief is maybe, you know, no one can really figure out what Mark Zuckerberg is thinking 20 moves ahead like he can, but the belief is maybe he one day will try to run for something. Maybe it's president, maybe it's governor, maybe it's mayor, maybe it's some, you know, something on the UN, who knows? Only he really knows what he's thinking. But the but right now, 2020 doesn't look like it's in the cards.
You mentioned in a column that you wrote a number of months ago that president weirdly seems like sort of a demotion for Zuckerberg, that the vast network operation that he controls. Do you think that he's become a much more personable guy since the sort of, you know, the social network era of his career? But do you think he wants to put up with the like totally public political part of running for office? Because his transcontinental tour, as you say, he controlled it, right? He had a photographer taking pictures. There's something kind of sweet and charming and goofy about it, but it's also staged. It's not retail politics as we know them. Do you think that he's comfortable doing that?
It's a great question. I think that yes and no. I think Zuck actually really enjoys the limelight that he has as a result of starting Facebook and running it. He has millions of people that follow his Facebook page. And I think he likes the power he has, you know. I mean, from all different levels of the company. I mean, imagine for a moment that I said to you that you sent a tweet that was seen by literally a quarter of the planet. You'd be like, that's it, I'm done. I don't need to do anything else with my life. Like, this is a product that literally 2.25 billion people use on a monthly basis, and a billion plus use on a daily basis, which is incredible. And I think that for him, you know, he kind of enjoys it. He loves this like attention and the power that he has and the influence he can have. And I think that's a big reason why he started the Zuckerberg Chan initiative. And I think that Bill Gates has actually played a huge role in kind of being a little bit of a mentor to Zuckerberg. But I think that he, you know, for someone like you or me, a quarter of a billion people doing and seeing anything that we had done would be like, that's it, game over, I'm out. Mic drop. For Mark Zuckerberg, it's not enough. And he wants more and more and more, and he needs, you know, to keep growing the company, he needs to keep growing his influence, he needs to change the world. And I think that this is just part of that quest to do that.
To play a slightly, I guess, sort of only partly hypothetical game, I'm now imagining a debate between Donald Trump and Mark Zuckerberg, even though, as you said, he's not going to run in 2020. I remember, I think a number of years ago, Zuckerberg was going to be interviewed at Code by Mossberg and Kara Swisher, yeah. And he got very sweaty. There was some like very uncomfortable moment. He got all schwitzy. Donald Trump also has a large social presence, but he is, you know, for better or worse, like, he does his shtick pretty well when the camera's rolling, a little bit too well right now, it seems like. Do you think that Zuckerberg could stand up against Trump if he is running for president at one point or other? It does seem as though he'll have to at least confront that in one way. Can he take on a sort of political bully in a, I guess, not entirely politically correct setting? Is he able to push back against the sort of meanness of retail politics, do you think? Is he comfortable doing that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting. When I first wrote about Zuck possibly running for office earlier this year, kind of putting all the dots together and so on, I think that the response was really amazing. And it, you know, it blew up on my social media, Twitter and Facebook and so on, with people commenting on it. And a lot of people were, you know, were like, this is amazing. We could finally have a candidate who understands technology as technology is changing our lives. You've got like Donald Trump and other politicians who brag about the fact that they don't use a computer, which I think is just the most moronic thing on earth. And then you have, but so people were very excited about that. But then there was a lot of people that were, you know, were saying not very nice things about Zuckerberg and his religion and so on and so forth. And, you know, I think that would, you know, the people that voted for Trump, I don't know if they would want to vote for someone like Zuck. You know, at the end of the day, I think that the good, you know, there's one positive thing that could be negative and could be positive that came out of Donald Trump becoming president. And that positive thing for me is that we no longer have to put up with career politicians who could give two shits about whether they end up making the world a better place, but really care about whether they become president. And as a result of that, you have someone like Mark Zuckerberg or Bob Iger that could potentially run for office one day. And I think that that's exciting because these are people who would take a different approach and probably have a better impact if they did actually seek office. You also get the flip side of that, which is, you know, The Rock and Kid Rock and Kanye and people like that who are going to try to run. But hopefully we'll get out of this reality TV culture of presidents after this one and move on to bigger, smarter, better people.
Well, I wouldn't be doing my job as a guest on Nick Bilton's Inside the Hive podcast if I didn't ask the one and only Nick Bilton about Twitter. I remember we were hanging out on the day that it was announced that Jack Dorsey was returning to Twitter. It was, I guess, October a couple of years ago. We were having coffee in San Francisco. I was asking you about it. And you looked at me like someone who had just watched his parents having sex. Like you were just like absolutely googly-eyed and mortified. Your mouth was on the floor. Your hair was curlier than ever. Your beard was beardier than ever. And you were just stunned. You were almost speechless.
It was shocking. Completely shocking.
So what? Two years later, Dorsey has not been able to move the needle on the stock price, right? The new products that he was the third era of Dorsey was supposed to bring in, like Moments, didn't really work out. Twitter, broadcast, the NFL, that didn't really work out. Necessarily Amazon's doing it now anyway. Twitter has still probably never been more popular. It's been totally hijacked by the leader of the free world. Where do you see Twitter in a year or two? It's been unable to successfully sell itself. We went through that whole psychodrama in the last 6 months. Is there a happy exit for Jack Dorsey, for Donald Trump, for the universe, mankind?
There's no happy exit ending for Donald Trump, but for Jack Dorsey, I think that you know, the thing I will give Jack credit for is he is very strategic. And very much like Zuckerberg is able to think 20 moves ahead. Maybe he thinks 10 moves ahead. Zuckerberg thinks 20. But I think that Jack probably knew all along that he couldn't save the company. That, you know, if you haven't heard about Twitter and signed up for it in 2017, while it's being used for, you know, to discuss, nuclear arms warfare between, two large man babies, then you are not signing up for Twitter. You know, the number of people who have signed up for that company is, I believe, close to a peak. And I think that Jack knew that too. I think he knew he could kind of tweak the numbers here and there, get a few more people. But at the end of the day, I think that the goal was always for him to save the company by landing it somewhere. And Disney, from what I've heard, the Disney deal was really, really close. The problem wasn't just Twitter and the trolls and all that stuff. That was part of it. But it was at the time Disney was dealing with the ESPN problems and so on and so forth. And they said, do we really want to bring on another company and product that that could have potential problems like that? And I think that the goal for Jack has always been to sell the company save it from dying by landing it somewhere and parachute out of there. And from what I've heard, and this is just theory and speculation from people close to him, the reason he's always stayed at Square is not because he wants to run both companies, but if, let's just say, Disney were to acquire Twitter and it were to be folded into Disney, Jack doesn't want to be just a guy working at Disney. Jack has bigger and grander goals. And so he could sell the company and say, oh, I can't come over because I got to go run this thing called Square over here. But thanks a lot. Great to see you. Good luck. And then he goes back to Square and maybe eventually transitions out of there and goes to run Disney or something like that, which I think is his dream in life. But I think that the problem is that it's a double-edged sword to get there, because the stock, even though the share price is hovering near its lowest again, it's not low enough, and that company is not worth $30 billion, which is what it was trying to seek. It's worth probably a third of that, honestly. And so in order to successfully land that company somewhere, I think Jack is going to have to get the stock price down a little bit more, and then there'll be potential suitors that could actually buy it.
Is there any one company, and I'll this is my last Twitter question of the moment, but is there any one company that sticks out to you as potentially a Twitter acquirer?
You know, I mean, I think it's a really difficult one. I think that someone like Verizon or something like that could be acquired. Does Jack want to be the guy that sells to Verizon? Or Comcast? I don't think so. You know, the most obvious that would probably benefit from it the most, you know, is like a Disney or an Apple or a Google. You know, Apple, I don't think needs it right now. I mean, I think they have an incredible social network on everyone's phone called iMessages. You know, I do think Apple could do a lot with Twitter, but it's also like, do you really want to be do you really want to own the company that where Donald Trump is accusing, you know, the New York Times of being fake news and spouting off about how he wants to blow up North Korea and this, that, and the other? I think that that's the biggest problem for Twitter, and so therefore it is a really difficult sell. And then finally, the biggest problem, I think, is that the bots, you know, that the bots is one of the most overreported, underreported aspects of Twitter, where there are a large percentage of even the active accounts on Twitter, I believe, are bots. And Twitter can't necessarily take them all offline, because if it does, its active user base will drop. And anyone doing due diligence on that company probably will discover this. And so therefore, they're not necessarily getting 328 million active users. They're probably getting a little less than that.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. It's amazing. It's also amazing that you can have a massive multi-billion-dollar company and one of your objectives is potentially how you shake out in all of it and how people think of you. But I guess that's just Silicon Valley.
That's the title of your memoir, John. I guess it's just Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I guess so. Nick Bilton, thanks for having me on, dude. I can't wait for the next time.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. This has been great. We should we'll come back in 10 years and see how many bots are on Twitter and if Travis is running Uber again and if Mark Zuckerberg is the president of the United States. Or the world.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Thanks to my co-host today, John Kelly. You can read the columns and stories he referenced in our conversation on the Hive section of the Vanity Fair website. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with me, your host, Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a nice review when you're there. Thanks to the folks at Digital Media for their production work, and I will see you all next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.